Over the next hour, we'll hear from Republican Todd Rokita, Democrat Tara Nelson, and Libertarian Benjamin Gelhausen. Each will make a brief opening statement and then answer questions posed by our audience here at the Mallett Theater and listening to WBAA. Following the questions, each candidate will make a brief closing statement. The order the candidates will speak was determined by drawing numbers, and our first opening statement comes from Democrat Tara Nelson.
Hi, thank you for coming and sharing in this tonight. My name is Tara Nelson. I'm running for U.S. Congress to represent Indiana's 4th District. I'm from Lafayette, which is the new center of District 4. I've worked for 12 years at two Fortune 500 companies, Eli Lilly and Great Lakes Chemical. I'm an IT project manager with a PMP certification, which stands for Project Management Professional. I've been also elected as president of South Haven Villas for 6 years. I'm a mother, and my daughter, Alexa Nelson, is here with me tonight, too. My goal while in Congress is to promote job growth in the U.S. and protect Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare for the middle class, and also to reduce our deficit. The current Congress approval rating in 2012 is a staggering 12%, tying the lowest rating in 38 years. We have a choice to elect better representatives to Congress. Our Constitution says it's the job of Congress to promote the general welfare of Americans, and also it's the job to regulate commerce. Our current Congress is not doing their job, but I intend to. Our current Congress will not pass a Paycheck Fairness Act for women, and they will not pass a jobs bill at a time when we need it most. Instead, they voted 30-odd times to repeal affordable care. We have record unemployment rates, not because of the past 4 years, but because of the past 30 years, when our good-paying manufacturing and tech jobs started being offshored overseas. We have a choice to reduce our deficit in a responsible way by removing waste from our military contracts and reducing the billions spent in foreign aid. Okay, I look forward to your questions tonight.
Next opening statement comes from Libertarian Benjamin Gelhausen.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Purdue University. And as a student at Purdue, I'd like to all welcome you to the campus that I've been attending classes on for the last 8 years. I'm 25 years old. This is my first time ever doing anything like this. I started out as a concerned citizen, entering an economy that was not working and still hasn't really grown in any substantial amount. As a kid, I grew up in the 90s when I thought prosperity was, you know, something that just came as a natural given. I didn't understand how much work that it took to run a strong economy. 4 years ago, I found out about a man named Ron Paul, and I found out about libertarianism. And it's one of the most difficult political stances to understand and learn about. But I feel that, you know, after 4 years of study, I understand it. A lot of the problems that are going on today by not watching national news media. And having a different lens to look through. We have the Federal Reserve is currently expanding our monetary supply at great rates. And I think that, you know, if we don't watch what the Federal Reserve is doing, they will quickly debase our currency, which will cause a lot of the prices for goods and services that we currently receive to go up to unaffordable levels. On top of that, I think our military venturism is hurting us as well. So thank you all for coming. Look forward to the debate.
Thank you. Republican Todd Rokita, your opening statement.
Good evening, and thank you all for being here tonight. I'm Todd Rokita, and it's been an honor and a privilege to serve Indiana's 4th District in Washington, D.C. for the last 2 years. I want to start tonight by telling you the truth, just like I've been telling the truth for the last 2 years about the condition of this country and the federal government. As I stand and talk with you tonight, we are $16 trillion in debt. By 2080, if we last that long, we will be $100 trillion in debt. 42% of your federal government spending every year now is on borrowed money. Not just borrowed from us as private citizens, but borrowed increasingly, about half, from countries, other countries, who by definition don't have our best interests at heart. But there are solutions, and we've offered them over the last 2 years as well. And I'm confident, as the people of Indiana continue to hear the truth, as difficult as it may sound, as the people of this country continue to hear the truth, as difficult as it may sound, we will win the day, because I've seen it happen right here in Indiana. I was humbled to be part of a team including Mitch Daniels and Becky Skillman, Richard Murdoch, and other statewide officials when I was Secretary of State that took this state from hundreds of million dollars in debt to hundreds of million dollars in surplus. When we had a health insurance issue, we created the Healthy Indiana Plan. Without taxing our future generations 1 cent, we were able to cover 40,000 more people. That's how I'm confident that this nation will come through it once they hear the truth. And I look forward to your questions.
Thank you very much. We're going to go to the questions. And the first question will be answered by Benjamin Gelhausen. He'll have 60 seconds. The two other candidates will each get 45 seconds. And this question is, how do you intend to keep Medicare and Medicaid funded for future generations?
I don't really believe that welfare is the right aspect. I believe that's a symptom that only creates more spending. Although I do believe that is more that current Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid is more necessary than invading foreign countries and bombing them and harming their country. Past examples include Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan, and we're quickly on the path to war with Iran. I don't believe in this idea of preemptive war that was taken hold of by George W. Bush and his fellow Republicans at the time. And I would rather cut our military adventurism overseas and bring our troops back in order to take care of our current Americans that are reliant upon those systems.
45 seconds to Tara Nelson.
Okay. I think that Medicaid and Medicare should be protected just as Social Security needs to be protected as well. I think they're all in a package that I call our social safety net, something that's very important to our middle class. And I'd just like to share some statistics with you that as far as Social Security, 100% of the benefits are secured until 2033. And after that, 75% will still be funded after that. And an average annual benefit to retired workers is $14,800. Of those 65 and older, two-thirds can count on Social Security for 50% or more of their income. It's very important to protect these programs for our middle class, and it would be devastating to our middle class America if these programs were taken away. And I feel that funding them, we need to reduce the wasted military contracts.
Thank you. 45 seconds, Mr. Rokita.
I appreciate the question, and we're the only ones that have a serious plan to address this issue. If you look at the Ryan budgets that I've been a part of crafting that passed the House, you'll see that we want to raise the age of eligibility for these programs because we're living a lot longer now. And these programs, when they were designed for a much lower age. Secondly, we should make these programs the insurance policies they were intended to be. While they may be important for the middle class, they're absolutely crucial for the poor. And that's what we should be insuring against. So a more aggressive means test. And then finally, we were very specific. We think that insurance companies, after they are made to not exclude anybody, should compete for your business. And you should be able to choose among the same kind of insurance policies for your Medicare plan that I get to as a member of Congress. No one else is addressing the situation except us. If you have a better idea, we'd love to hear it. But you can have no defense department, quite frankly, and you wouldn't address the drivers of our debt, and you would still bankrupt these programs.
Time, sir. The next question firstly goes to Tara Nelson, and it's, many elected officials and those running for office say they will vote to repeal the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. Would you support repeal? What do you propose to address the issue of Americans without health insurance?
Well, I do not support the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, but I would also like to tack on to what the congressman was saying about Social Security benefits and the means test. And from what we've seen from the Romney-Ryan tax plan has been nothing. They haven't released any details, so right now it is a secret plan. And we're getting details as we're watching the presidential debates, and there will be another one tonight at 9 p.m. But from what we've seen so far, they're talking about reducing taxes on the middle class by eliminating the mortgage tax, the child tax credit, education, and charity taxes, and that's not going to help our middle class. And I also just wanted to say another way to fund Social Security contribution would be that the contribution tax doesn't apply to earnings above $110,000. So if we can continue to tax earnings above that rate, that would fully fund Social Security and would help our middle class and help them in retirement. I do support affordable care.
Thank you. Mr. Rokita. Sure. Would you support repeal of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and what do you propose to address the issue of Americans without health insurance?
Yes, I voted over 30 times to repeal the Affordable Care Act for several reasons. Once government controls your health and the care of your health, they control your life. And that's wrong. It's got to stop. It's immoral. We can make better decisions for ourselves than any nanny government can. Number two, the Affordable Care Act is unaffordable. Furthermore, it guts Medicare by the tune of $700 billion in order to put more people on the Affordable Care Act. So it takes away from those most vulnerable, our senior citizens, to do this. In its place, I would put market-driven reforms like health savings accounts, empowering ourselves to choose between insurance programs to make sure that we as consumers are empowered to make the better decisions. That would naturally drive down the cost. Thank you.
Mr. Gallhausen.
I am against the Affordable Care Act, even though it was ruled by Justice John Roberts this summer that it was a tax instead of a mandate. I believe it is another tax that we should not be subjected to. We have a lot of taxes already. I don't look forward to paying taxes. I believe that Americans should be entitled to 100% of their income. We could look at taxes like property taxes and capital gains taxes, but income tax is something I think, right now we have a hard enough time getting a job and keeping that job. I think that we should be allowed to keep the fruits of our labor. So I don't believe that, affordable health care thing, I think the thing we need to be looking at is prices and the cost of health care. If we can look at ways at reducing cost of health care, then we'd be better.
Thank you. I want to remind listeners at home that you can submit questions via email to news@wbaa.org or using Twitter, #IN4. Our next question is, as an entrepreneur and small business owner, we find increasing levels of regulation that stymie our ability to grow and function. What are you doing or what do you plan to do to help small business owners deal with this bureaucracy? And the first one to respond is Mr. Rokita.
Thank you. Business owners are being strangled. They're being strangled by an overzealous federal government that regulates in areas that they never have before and regulates to a degree that we have never seen. Furthermore, they're being regulated by activists who have no personal knowledge or experience over in the industries over which they regulate. All this has concocted to become a regulatory state that you can't even create a business. Harder to create a business in this country than in many others anymore. And that has to be changed. For my part, I started what we call, with the Indiana Chamber of Commerce as a partner, the Red Tape Rollback Program. 71 businesses approached me about 41 different regulations that were hurting them from creating jobs. And we're claiming 23 victories in our annual report. We got the regulation stopped from even being implemented. After implementation, we got it rolled back, or we created legislation and got it passed to take that authority away from the agency. So we got real results already in the first 2 years.
Thank you. Mr. Gallhausen.
On this issue, I'm in agreement with Congressman Rokita here. The regulations, all they serve to do is harness businesses. I know that I am not a small business owner myself, but I do understand that, they are hurting. I know that Dodd-Frank and Sarbanes-Oxley have created a paperwork nightmare for small businesses that would be better served, focusing on running their business rather than filing paperwork or, spending money on somebody to do that paperwork for them. But the more money that we have to commit to complying with federal regulations is the less money that they get to keep and, save for a rainy day or spend on other goods and services that their family may need. So absolutely get rid of regulations.
Ms. Nelson.
I think we need smarter regulations, and I absolutely support small business. Small business accounts for a lot of our employment, and we need to help these companies succeed. Right now, the Indiana unemployment rate is at 8.2%, which is pretty high. And I think we need to do what we can for the small businesses to help them so they're hiring new employees. As an IT project manager, I've been asked to offshore jobs overseas working at a Fortune 500 company. And I think we also need to regulate big corporations to provide better tax incentives so they're hiring American workers instead of offshoring jobs. And as a manager, when I was asked to offshore my team, I created a business case to keep their jobs here. And I think we need more people fighting for jobs here, and that's what I intend to do.
Thank you. The next question, first answer, is Mr. Gelhausen. So many of our young people are graduating from college with tens of thousands of dollars in debt. What should Congress do to help alleviate this situation? Specifically, what is your stance on Pell Grants?
I'm amongst those college students that is graduating with $50,000 in debt when I get out of Purdue. And, you know, I went into college, you know, thinking that I was going to have a job when I got out. And then the collapse happened. And, you know, I'm here 8 years later, double majoring in professional flight technology and economics. And I got a minor in philosophy along the way. What government should do to better help college students is stay out of the way. The more that we try to donate, the more the government tries to get involved in anything, the better it gets at failing. So I fear that if the government, you know, they don't understand what's going on, and, you know, the more we try to help, you know, we just need to get the economy going back so we can have the jobs to pay the debt off, rather than try to, you know, put more taxpayer money and, you know, let us leech off of taxpayer money. I mean, we need to save money and get this debt under control.
Ms. Nelson.
I believe the way to have affordable college is to, absolutely we need Pell Grants, but I think we also need to eliminate taxes or tax interest rates from our student loans, because we're making money off of our future, and I think that we need to look at education as an investment in our entire country. So I'm completely against putting interest rates on the students who are trying to go through college. I think we need to change the way we think about our future.
Mr. Rakita?
Yeah, I think Tara and BJ are both right. It is wrong for the federal government to be making money off these loans, but the way to do it is to get the federal government out of the way. And let me explain why. In 1992, the cost of tuition at Purdue was about $2,500. Now it's over $9,000. And this is setting aside room and board. Right, Ben? Okay, that's a 400% increase. The rise in inflation over that same time period is 2%. I'd like Purdue and every other college and university in the nation to explain that kind of increase. There is no moral reason for it, except for the fact that the federal government is printing more money and putting it on the academic street, so to speak, and that is allowing the price to artificially inflate. We need to innovate in our colleges and universities. We need to treat them as businesses and have them compete again to drive down costs. Thank you.
Next question is for Tara Nelson. Women's rights are at the forefront. How do you feel about, and explain, Lilly Ledbetter, Planned Parenthood, and healthcare costs for pre-existing conditions for women?
Healthcare costs for pre-existing conditions for women. I think women nowadays are sort of being treated as a pre-existing condition, and our insurance is not great. So I think there's a lot that still needs to happen, especially with the Affordable Care Act. As I said, I support it. I don't feel that it's perfect, though. I think we have a ways to go to make it where it needs to be. I'd like to address Planned Parenthood, who does not use any federal funding for abortion, and they offer a lot of preventative services and cancer screenings for men and women. And it's a very good community-based organization, and I think we need to keep funding it because they're providing good services for the community.
Mr. Rakita.
Thank you. I keep hearing about this war on women, but I can't get any specifics on the war. What is it? That some of the people in this country, majority of the people in this country, refuse to have their tax dollars pay for other people's contraception? Is that the war on women? What is exactly going on here? What exactly is going on here is a watch the birdie moment. Since the president and his allies and his party cannot talk about the economy, all these wars are being made up. You know what I think a war on women is, and quite frankly, the rest of us? When we're paying $4 and above for a gallon of gas and we don't need to be. That's a war on women and the families that they support. Let's get to the real issues here. Let's get to the economy and why it's so bad. And when you do, you'll find out that the president's policies and ideology is the reason for it.
Mr. Gelhausen.
I'm not sure if I understood the question. Could you please repeat it?
Basically, how do you feel about the Lilly Ledbetter Act, Planned Parenthood, and health care costs for pre-existing conditions for women?
I'm not too familiar with the Lilly Ledbetter Act. Once again, I'll use this time to talk about the cost of health care. It's kind of what Congressman Rokita was talking about with, you know, money coming from the federal government or from the Federal Reserve and being put into colleges, increasing the price. The same, we can look to health care, which is another reason why I'm afraid of the Affordable Health Care Act. You take more money and you give it to health care, guess what? Our costs are going to go up even higher. Economics is something that, you know, that's taught me that. And, just looking at costs and how to keep them down and, you know, trying to, it's called a moral hazard. If you look into Ron Paul's book, Liberty Defined or Revolution Manifesto, he'll adequately explain how HMOs have, you know, made this worse. So,
time. Thank you. Mr. Rokita, you get the next question first. The gross air pollution and water pollution in Indiana need controls. How will you support the EPA and pollution prevention?
The question was they need controls?
According to the question.
Okay, so that's more of a statement than a question, I would say, first of all. So, look, I think our water, I know our water and our air has been cleaner than at any other time in the post-industrialized world. And that's because we had balance in our laws. That balance has gone amok. We are completely imbalanced, masochistic even, in the way that we go about this. Every other country in the world understands that it, when it pulls something from the ground and processes it, it creates wealth for its citizens. Yet because of the activists who are in charge of the EPA, we're not allowed to do that kind of thing anymore, especially here in Indiana where you can use coal in a responsible and clean way. And that's because at the end of the day, this isn't just about clean air or clean water. It's about controlling your life. And once government can control not only your health care, but what you're allowed to use for energy, it can control your every move.
Thank you. Mr. Gelhausen.
With regards to the EPA whether or not it is a necessity, I don't believe in the long run that it is, but what needs to happen is environmental education. We need to ingrain our young people with a sense of environmental responsibility and the importance of taking care of this planet. We only have one livable planet that we know of right now. And, you know, if we do not work, take that little bit of extra effort. I mean, you guys see it all over the place at sporting events. How many times do you see trash laying around everywhere? I mean, people don't care. So what we need to have is a sense of responsibility at an individual level to understand that we need to take care of our environment and do the extra work that is required, even if that means bending over and picking up trash. It's easy, just do it.
Thank you. Ms. Nelson.
Yeah, I also agree. I support clean air, clean water, and also being responsible. But I would like to tell you about this war on women, if I could, for a minute. The gender wage gap, in 1967, women only earned 58 cents to a man's dollar. And today, women only earn 77 cents today to a man's dollar. That's the war on women that we're talking about, Congressman. In 2010, almost two-thirds of families had women as their breadwinners. This is not a women's issue, it's also a family issue. And we need to pass a Paycheck Fairness Act for women.
Okay. Next question goes to Mr. Gelhausen. What is your position on the National Defense Authorization Act and the reduction in civil liberties associated with it?
With regards to the National Defense Authorization Act, I believe in 2012, John McCain helped author the bill. It basically made it legal for the United States government to hold any individual, regardless of, you know, American citizen or not, captive without due process and, under suspicion of terrorism. And I believe we're on a slippery slope here with, you know, trying to label people as terrorists. I mean, we could label anybody as a terrorist. I mean, that's the thing with philosophy. You can make any argument if you want to. And if we do not clearly define terrorism, which it's impossible to clearly define it because you have to understand who's being wrong or who's being wrong and who's being the aggressor. So I do not support the National Defense Authorization Act. There was an interview I was watching recently where a government spokesperson would not admit that they have anybody has been affected by this. So we need to watch out for bills like that.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson.
I do support the National Defense Act, and also have an opportunity coming up here on November 12th to go see Ground Zero in New York. And I was invited to be honored at Glamour's Women of the Year Awards, held in New York at Carnegie Hall. And because this year women are running for Congress in a record rate, and 296 filed and 181 women are on the general election ballot. That's 163 for the House and 18 for the Senate. And Congress is currently only 17% female, while the U.S. population is 51%. So I'm excited to go visit Ground Zero, and I absolutely support our troops.
Mr. Rokita, your position on the National Defense Authorization Act.
Yeah, I agree with BJ. It's Ben. Ben or BJ?
BJ.
BJ, okay. On this issue as well, I actually voted against the National Defense Authorization Act when it was first put on the floor, and that's because I didn't think it had the constitutional safeguards and civil rights protections. And I thought that was very important. And I worked in a bipartisan way, Democrat and Republican legislators, to get a successful amendment put in to that act regarding the right of habeas corpus. And so not only is that an example where I stand on the National Defense Authorization Act, it's also an indication of my willingness at every turn to work in a bipartisan manner when you're not going to destroy our future generations with more debt.
Thank you. More of a philosophical question, and this is going to Ms. Nelson first. What is the purpose of government? Why does it exist?
Well, the purpose of government and why it exists, I believe, is spelled out in our Constitution. And it's clearly stated in there the role of Congress, and that is to promote the general welfare of Americans and also to regulate commerce. So I feel that our role in Congress is to follow through and follow our Constitution, because I think our forefathers put a lot of thought into our Constitution, and I think we need to and continue to uphold it today. And I don't feel that the current Congress is doing that. They're kind of on their own agenda, but I intend to follow the Constitution.
Okay. Mr. Rokita.
Thank you. Yes, the role of the federal government is definitely spelled out in our Constitution, an excellent document that put the best ideas for self-governance that the world had ever known to date and since together in the same document at the same time. It hadn't been done before, and that's a cornerstone of our American exceptionalism. But the General Welfare Clause is really in the preamble. I mean, if you think about it, the founders were smarter than this. If they said something like general welfare, anything could be included as a federal government duty. But they didn't do that. Instead, they had, through the 10th Amendment and other places, the enumerated powers. 17 direct responsibilities of the federal government. A third of those regard our national defense. And the rest of all government was to be left to us as individuals and to the states. No federal involvement at all.
Mr. Gough.
What I think government should be is just mostly used to protect us from foreign invaders. If we look to government as a social safety net, as Franklin Delano Roosevelt did, we ended up getting in a lot of trouble. And his policies have only served to create the situation that we're currently living in today. We had a question earlier about what I believe the government should do with regards to students. I mean, I don't believe the government should help us out. I mean, this is a personal responsibility thing. The more that we task government to do, the more it will fail. And, we're always looking for somebody to look after us. And the moment we think that somebody's looking out for us, we instantaneously kind of let our guard down. So I believe that the role of government is to protect a group of individuals that make up the United States of America from foreign attacks.
This is a 4th Congressional District Forum on WBAA. You can submit questions via Twitter using the hashtag IN4 or email them to news@wbaa.org. The next question goes to Mr. Rokita first. How do you plan to serve constituents from other parties or who did not vote for you?
Well, quite simply, it's the same model that I used for 8 years as Secretary of State. Everyone is my constituent, and that's the culture I've tried, and I think tried successfully, to develop with my staff. We also have three offices. The congressional district right now is 200 miles long. The new one will be just about as long. And so we have make sure we have offices not just in Washington, D.C., but where my constituents are. And that, again, coupled with the culture of service, no one gets asked when you call my office if you're a Republican or Democrat, because it doesn't matter. Everyone's to be talked with as if they were the most important person that's ever called. And if anyone doesn't think that's the case, I certainly personally want to know about it, and I'd be shocked to, given the kudos that my staff gets in the state of Indiana. So it's a matter of leadership, it's a matter of culture, and it's a matter of serving everyone, regardless of the votes in an election.
Thank you. Mr. Gelhausen.
And the question was regarding?
How would you serve constituents from a party other than your own or who did not vote for you?
All right. How I would conserve constituents in a party of my own? I'm with a congressman on this. I look at people as people. They're human beings, especially if they're my constituents. You know, I would treat everybody the same. That's how I was taught to. That's how I was raised, and that's how I run my daily life. We're all individuals here, and we all have problems that are unique and nonpartisan in nature. It just happens to be that, you know, sometimes we may disagree, but that's how we need to act as acting adults, to help each other, because, you know, I would not, you know, neglect anybody based on party affiliation. So I'll pass.
Thank you. Ms. Nelson.
I also agree with Ben and the congressman on the issue of representing all constituents, and I feel it is important to listen to everyone, and I will always have an open ear and encourage new dialect in any conversation of any issue that's bothering you that should be addressed at the federal level. I've also attended some of Rokita's town halls and was interested to listen to the issues of the district. So I absolutely have an open ear and would like to hear from everyone.
Thank you. This next question goes to Mr. Gelhausen first. In order to reduce the national deficit, would you be willing to give up franking privileges, cut salary and staff significantly, and pay for your own transportation costs should you be elected?
Would I be willing to give up benefits to pay for the debt?
Congressional benefits, cut your salary, cut your staff.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm willing to do anything that it takes to get rid of this deficit right now, because debt is called an obligation. And as long as we have outstanding obligations, we cannot be free, which is what the United States of America is supposed to be, a country of free men and women. And we cannot do that as long as we are in debt. I would look at cutting military spending, because right now I believe that our foreign adventurism has weakened our national defense. And if on top of that I'd have to cut my own pay or my staff, and I would be willing to do that, because then we could pay off our debt and get free soon. These obligations are just, you know, a big dark cloud that's been hanging over us right now. And whatever we can do to pay that off as soon as we can, that's the course of action I'd be most willing to take.
Ms. Nelson.
Okay. Yeah, I agree with Ben in that I would take a salary pay cut and also reduce my staff. And I don't think we really need franking, because to me, franking is when you're mailing out letters to your constituents to give them an update on your status, but it's more like campaigning. So I think you should be using campaign funds instead of taxpayer dollars when you're reaching out to your constituents. I think that's important to reduce the deficit, but I also agree with Ben that the way to reduce our deficit is to look at military spending. There's a lot of waste in our military contracts, and that's really the responsible way to reduce our deficit.
Thank you. Mr. Rokita.
Thank you. I would feel the same way if I knew that cutting my own office budget and whatever else you mentioned was part of a larger plan that really did solve the debt problem. But remember, I said that I would continue telling you the truth. And let me reiterate it. We are $16 trillion in debt. we have another $100 trillion on the way by 2080. What the good moderator just put in the question, whoever had the question, is nothing but a gimmick. It will not do anything to solve the problem. And by the way, Tara mentioned that she came to one of our town halls. She wouldn't have known, nor would any of you known about any of my town halls, if I didn't get the message out for you to come. I will continue to use my franking budget to make sure that you all stay informed and run a transparent office.
Time. Thank you. First answer comes from Ms. Nelson, and it was touched on already about the defense budget and the deficit, but how do you balance a budget when wars and military action cost billions a month currently? And how would demilitarization impact the national deficit?
Well, I have some more facts for you. The past decade of war has cost over $3.7 trillion and has also cost 225,000 lives. The war that we're in right now, we absolutely need to withdraw from. I have two grandfathers that served in World War II. One of them is still living. He's 90 and was just able to go see the World War II Memorial in D.C. He was an Army Air Force veteran. And also, Alexa's father has served three terms in Iraq and is also currently serving in Afghanistan. And I feel that we are outspending the next 20 countries combined when it comes to military spending. And cutting any kind of military defense, the Republicans will say will put our country at risk, which just absolutely isn't true. We're still outspending the next 20 countries combined. So we can reduce our military spending and still be able to defend our borders, which is what we need to do.
Mr. Akita.
This Republican doesn't think you can't cut defense. In fact, I'm pretty outspoken that you can make good cuts to defense. It's one of the fattest, sloppiest, overspent agencies we have. In fact, it cannot even be audited. Not that there's a statute prohibited, it's audit. It can't get to the audit table. And that's wrong. It's immoral for the troops. But again, since we're telling the truth, let's be clear. The debt has grown 50% in the last 4 years. It doesn't have much to do with these wars. It has to do with the two-thirds of our federal spending every year, and that boils down to three programs, Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security. You can have no defense department, and you'd only cut 20% of your federal spending.
Thank you. Mr. Gelhausen.
Yeah, I believe that, yeah, like you said before, you know, it's not only costing us money to promote these wars and fight them, but it's also costing American lives as well as international citizens' lives. And I think, you know, if we ask anybody, like, what are we fighting for? I mean, is it to install democracy overseas? I mean, is that even in the Constitution that we can do that? I mean, the only time I believe that we should be called to war is to defend an attack on our citizens. So yeah, if you look at that, and also, you know, there's departments that I don't feel do any good. Department of Homeland Security. Have any of you ever been glad to meet a TSA agent at the airport? Not me. I mean, I don't like getting frisked. I understand, and the bad people are going to figure out a way behind this anyway. So yeah, there's other things that we can talk about cutting too. So,
thank you, Mr. Akita. This question goes to you first. What role can or should government play in promoting job growth?
The best thing we can do to promote job growth at the federal government level is to stop over-regulating and to stop over-taxing. If we get the federal government out of the way, the private sector will create jobs. And going back to the previous question for just a second, it's also important to know, if we're telling the truth and fair is fair, of the drivers of our debt, well, I've already demonstrated that at 20% of our federal spend, the military isn't much of a driver of our debt at all. But it's the only agency, really, that so far has stood up and made cuts. It's in its second year of a 10-year plan to cut nearly $500 billion. When sequestration goes into place in whatever form, January 2nd, it will have to cut another $500 billion. Meanwhile, the real drivers of our debt, Medicare mostly, Social Security and Medicaid to follow, representing two-thirds of our debt, haven't cut anything, haven't reformed anything.
Mr. Gelhausen.
Alongside with Congressman Rokita, with getting rid of, trying to decrease taxes as well as getting rid of the debt and reducing regulations, I would also like to talk about the importance of a sound currency and also a committed plan. Right now, there's a lot of confusion. We don't know what's going on. With the price of gasoline, it keeps on going up, and the price of food is going up, and our wages are staying the same. That's called the inflation tax. You guys have probably never heard about the inflation tax, but it happens whenever money is expanded and the amount that you make still stays the same. I mean, it's whenever the Federal Reserve increases the money supply, for them it's increasing the money supply. I try increasing the money supply, I get charged for counterfeiting. You know, I mean, you look at the soundness of currency, so.
Ms. Nelson.
Yeah, I just would like to say I had a great time this summer campaigning around the district and attended many festivals and parades. And at one of the parades, I met Richard Murdoch, and we had a chance to talk about jobs. And I let him know I used to work at Lilly, and he said he had a conversation with the CEO, John Lechleiter, who pointed out to him they get a 26% tax break to offshore jobs. That's staggering. So we need to have a role in Congress to change our tax incentives so we're not shipping jobs overseas. We need to change our tax incentives so that companies are hiring here in America. And that's absolutely what I feel needs to be done.
Mr. Gelhausen, you get the next question first. How would you change corporate taxes and why?
I'm not too familiar with the corporate tax code, but I am familiar with how taxes only leech off of productivity and give it to government, which tends to not be productive. So I would look at, I would like to reduce income taxes because I believe that American citizens should be receiving their full wages worth of money or whatever you get paid in. After we can get rid of income taxes, then I would look at corporate taxes. I would look at capital gains taxes. With regard to capital gains, shouldn't you be paid your full what you're fully entitled to with your benefits? I mean, this is a very difficult question that's going on right now because I would like to reduce the taxes as much as possible, but at the same time, we're looking at this debt. So I believe here the fair tax people make a really good argument with regards to taxes on consumption. That's just something that I'd be willing to explore within the next 4 years and try to understand that better.
Ms. Nelson.
Can you repeat the question, please?
Sure. How would you change corporate taxes and why?
I feel that it's pretty much the same question as before. In my view, I would change corporate taxes by giving tax incentives for the companies to hire American workers and reduce the tax incentives we have now to offshore jobs. I think that just has to be done. And as I mentioned, as an IT manager, I did what I could to save jobs here in America. And not a lot of managers are standing up for what is right. They're taking the orders and they're being told to offshore your team, offshore work. We need to do this to cut the budget. We don't have enough managers standing up for American jobs. And that's something that I stood hard in. And that's something that I absolutely will do in Congress as well.
Thank you. Mr. Rokita.
Thank you. I know Mr. Lechleiter, I know very well Mr. Murdoch. I can guarantee you that whatever the conversation was, it's just been interpreted wrongly. Here is what probably was said. We are the only country on the face of the earth to have what we called a worldwide tax system. The rest of the countries have a territorial system. And what that means is that when Eli Lilly, for example, makes a profit in Ireland, they get taxed by the Irish government, and then they get taxed by our government. And no other multinational headquartered company that's headquartered outside the U.S. has that problem. So what we've proposed to do and already voted on doing is saying, you know what, if you made your profit in another country, that's okay. Now bring the cash. Now bring the profit back and use it for research and development here and hire people here, not overseas. That's what's causing jobs to go overseas, is our outdated, arcane tax code.
Ms. Nelson, you get the next question first. The dilemma of 11 million undocumented individuals in our country is frequently discussed, but no concrete solutions have emerged. What measures do you support for dealing with the immigration problem?
Well, I think the majority of us have immigrated from another country, so I think we need to show compassion to those who are trying to gain citizenship in our country. I think there needs to be a pathway to citizenship, and I think we also need better border control. Otherwise, that wouldn't be happening. I think that answers that question. So I'd like to also touch back on how to reduce our deficit again. The congressman has talked about he's not even going to try cutting the budget in other areas, such as, well, he said he would cut it in military, but he wouldn't cut it in his congressional office. And I just wanted to point out, when he was advertising for the town hall meetings, he was using taxpayer dollars and franking, and he had $800,000 in his campaign account. So I feel that he could have used his own personal funds to advertise for those meetings without at the expense of the taxpayers.
Thank you. Mr. Okita.
And I hope if I'm selected by the people of this district to represent them another 2 years, I have even more money in my campaign account. I will continue to use my franking budget to communicate with the people of my district, and I don't apologize for it. Secondly, to the question at hand, been very active and leading in my caucus on making sure that those who come here on visas to study at places like Purdue at some cost of the taxpayers aren't sent back to their home countries to become millionaires or otherwise lead their lives. I just assume those students, excellent Hoosiers to be, stay right here and become millionaires here and add to our job base and our economic growth. And that's the end of the immigration problem that I've been most focused on, with some degree of success. We got a bill on the floor. We lost it because it was required a two-thirds vote, but we're going to set the stage to bring it back next Congress, and that's where I want to focus.
Time. Mr. Gelhausen.
It's hard to, I question the validity of the research. I mean, how can you, if they're undocumented, how do we know there's 11 million of them? I think that, you know, anybody that wants to live in this country deserves a fair and equal shot to live in this country. That's what our ancestors came here for, is a fair and equal opportunity as well as second chances. Botero talked about border security. Maybe we should probably do a better job of that. It's a big border. So, I mean, really, you know, immigration is probably one of my weakest issues, but, you know, I welcome immigrants into this country, and, you know, if they, you know, just to compete for jobs, because this is a great country to live in, and I'm glad that other people think that way too.
The next question goes to Mr. Okita first. How would you work on stopping street drugs and crime in America?
Well, that's a pretty broad question, but I'll give it my shot. I think the best way to combat that, and this is being a quasi-law enforcement officer when I was Secretary of State, we regulated white-collar crime. So different than I think where the question was coming from, but some experience in law enforcement nonetheless. The best way to handle that, the most effective way to handle that, is at the local and state level. I think there's very little room for federal government involvement. I am quite frankly alarmed at the thousands of federal crimes that now exist by statute made by the Congress. I think that represents a very scary situation. Local standards and local communities should determine what crimes are and what the punishment should be, not necessarily federal law. And law enforcement should be left up in as many cases as possible that don't involve a direct constitutional authority to local governments and local law enforcement.
Mr. Gelhausen.
Well, the best way is to legalize them. I mean, look at the war on drugs. I mean, has that been a success? Has it? I mean, we spend, $100 million a year trying to enforce drug laws that people still find a way to get around it? I mean, I don't see any success from this Nixon policy that has still gone on to this day. I look at it as a waste of money. So with regards, to the marijuana industry especially, it's safer than alcohol, and it doesn't have as many, damaging effects. And I believe that our government can make a lot of money, taxing marijuana, just like they do with cigarettes. You know, people are going to do what they're going to do. We're individuals. We're smart. You know, and the only thing that I think we could better invest in is understanding addictive behavior and drug use and figuring out ways to help people that are in that dark part of life.
Thank you. Ms. Nelson.
Well, I think to address the drug war and the street war and the gang activity, I think that is best left to the local and state government. I don't feel that the federal government has a role in that, although they do have some role at different levels. But I think it's best left up to the local police and the state police to handle those matters.
Okay. Next question goes to Mr. Gelhausen first, and this has to do, it's via the email. and it has to do with the recent outbreak of fungal meningitis. The questioner says, federal regulation of compounding pharmacies was dropped a few years back. What would you do to protect us from this kind of thing?
With regards to trying to protect from disease outbreaks, that's a really hard question. I'm not sure if I know a good way to answer this, but getting the proper vaccinations, going to your doctor, trying to make sure that what enters this country isn't dangerous. Not too familiar with the outbreak. I do know that I had my vaccine for meningitis about 9 years ago. So making sure that we're all vaccinated against things that would potentially kill us. But I'm not sure I know how to properly answer that question. So,
Ms. Nelson,
I as an IT project manager don't have much experience with that. But I feel that our Centers of Disease Control can handle that kind of an outbreak, and I put my trust in them.
Mr. Rokita.
Well, it's a tragedy. And one of the things I don't like about Congress, things that I've observed so far, is that it's such a reactionary body these days. You look at bills like Dodd-Frank, 2,300 pages long, that was supposed to solve our financial issues back in 2008. And all it has done so far and will do is make it harder to get a loan. Completely reactionary, done within weeks of the financial meltdown. I don't want to make the same mistake with something like this. The facts are still out. We don't know if it was, based on the question, if it was a retraction of an old law, or if simply the law the laws that are still on the books weren't followed. So let's get the facts in and then go from there and see if there's a constitutional reason that the federal government should address this issue.
Thank you. Next question goes to Ms. Nelson. First, how do you view China as a trading partner?
I believe China has a lot of manufacturing jobs, and I feel that we've had a lot of jobs taken from America. I think we still need to keep our business relationship with them, but I know a lot of people who've worked in manufacturing who have lost their jobs to China. And although it's great to have cheap products from them, I think we need to utilize American workers more. And so I'm more supportive of bringing new business back to America. But we still need to keep China as an ally.
Mr. Rokita.
All right, I agree with Tara that we need to utilize American workers more. I think we have the best workforce in the world. And I would put our men and women up against any other workforce that I've seen in other countries that I visited on your behalf. But the way to make them competitive, the way to keep them strong, is not to put up walls. No country has ever been successful in the history of the world that put up a wall, whether it's a physical wall or an economic wall, like a barrier to trade. We have got to be competitive. Those people in the world who do a job or make a product most effectively and efficiently, they're the ones that should do that work. And our success will be in relying on our innovation and our freedom to innovate. That always has, and heretofore, kept us on the cutting edge. That's the recipe for success.
Mr. Gelhausen.
I view China as I don't know the history, but any country that wants to trade with us, I'm like Congressman Rokita just said, don't erect a wall. I mean, we shouldn't just cut off relationship with China just because they might overtake us in economic superiority. I mean, the moment we stop, being willing to negotiate with other nations just because they may become more powerful, we're just gonna go more steadily into a decline. So we need to keep our relationships with our countries and our trade partners open, and just in order to utilize our comparative advantage. Which, if you guys aren't familiar with that term, it means that we right now as the United States have a comparative advantage in services, and they have a comparative advantage in manufacturing. So, just whatever saves our time would be best.
Thank you. We don't have time for a full answer period, so I'm going to ask a question, and if you can limit yourself to 30 words or less.
30 words or 30 seconds?
30 words.
Okay. Oh my goodness.
Or 30 seconds. Do you believe in term limits? And this goes to Mr. Rokita.
Yeah, I do. I lived under a term limit when I was Secretary of State, and it's fine. Except for this, you have to change the Constitution in order to affect term limits in Congress. And I frankly believe that there are other amendments to the Constitution that we need to make first. And chief among them would be a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution to make sure we don't spend outside our means.
Sorry. Thank you. Mr. Galhausen.
I've thought long and hard about this, and I'm still undecided on term limits.
Okay.
Ms. Nelson.
I do believe we need term limits. I don't think we need congressional candidates or Senate candidates who are in office for over 30 years, who are kind of running the way the game is in Washington. I think having new people and new points of views in office at any area is a good thing. So I definitely support term limits.
Time now for closing statements. Each candidate gets 60 seconds, and we'll start with Mr. Rokita.
Thank you. I want to thank you all for attending again, and I want to thank the sponsors for doing this. It's important, and I'm privileged to be a part of it. If anyone was offended by the way I said something, please excuse me. If you're offended by what I said and don't think it's the truth, try to debunk me. I'm not doing this for a career. I'm not doing this for any other reason. I started 2 years ago with an experiment that we were going to have an adult conversation with the people of the 4th District about what's causing the debt in this country and what will cause future generations to have less economic liberty and less prosperity than we do right now, because I don't think that's moral. And I don't think it's the intention of anyone that I'm looking into the eyes of right now. Every generation before has wanted the next to be better off. I can tell you as a member of the Budget Committee, and the facts that I've given you tonight, all true, that we will not leave future generations better off if we don't take responsibility and some action now for reining in the drivers of our debt. And that's Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. The beautiful part is, and I'll end, is that if we do it now, we don't have to affect anyone on the program. It could be my generation's issue to take care of.
Thank you. Ms. Nelson.
I just want to repeat that the job of Congress is to promote the general welfare of Americans and also to regulate commerce. I intend to promote job growth by eliminating tax incentives to offshore jobs and create new tax incentives to hire American workers. I will also protect Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare for our middle class and for future generations. I have a responsible plan to reduce our deficit that will not impact our middle class. I'd like to share a quote with you from Professor George Lakoff. The central issue in this election is a moral issue. Who are we as Americans? Are we citizens who join together to form a great nation? Or are we isolated individuals with no commitments to each other at the mercy of corporations whose central goal is their short-term profit? I hope we choose to stand together, because too many families are counting on us. You can help my campaign and find out more about me by visiting my website at taranelsonforcongress.com. Thank you and have a great evening.
Thank you. Mr. Goss.
In closing, again, I've seen too many people nodding their heads off, so congratulations on staying awake. I realize some of this, what we're talking about today, is not the most interesting, but it is indeed necessary. Tough circumstances call for tough situations. And I'm willing to stand up to whatever we need to do in order to move our country forward and be prosperous for the next generation. I would like to close with a quote from Thomas Jefferson about about banking and fiat monetary systems. I believe that banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberties than standing armies. If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and corporations that will grow up around the banks will deprive the people of all property until their children wake up homeless on the continent that their fathers conquered. The issuing power should be taken for the banks and restored to the people to whom it properly belongs. I don't understand everything in that statement, but I'm going to keep trying to. Thanks.
On behalf of WBAA, the League of Women Voters of Greater Lafayette and Greater Lafayette Commerce, I want to thank the candidates for participating tonight. Thanks to everyone who submitted questions. This broadcast will be posted on WBAA.org. And also thanks to Rich Dion and Purdue's Department of Theater for use of the Carol and Gordon Mallett Theater tonight. And don't forget to vote Tuesday, November 6th. Thank you.